persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free.
Stand by. The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your mind.
Hello, I'm Jerry Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse and your brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage. You know, we should watch for Obama to accelerate his agenda to transform America during his last months in office. I mean, look what's going on with gun control. I mean, so many things. If we're not careful, we can miss the fact that he has more than a domestic agenda to, quote-unquote, transform America. It seems evident he has a global agenda that has, if possible, even more disturbing implications for the future of America than his effort to destroy our economy, our military, our Constitution, and the family. But let's start there anyway, because it's there we'll see what's going on overall in today's show. I think you're going to find out what Obama is up to and why. You'll understand his game plan, and you'll finally understand what, from the surface, seems so contradictory. I mean, his odd way of mixing together Christianity with Islam and the penchant he has for inciting racial unrest and at the same time undermining the Constitution. So, folks, hold on. Your brain is about to get a deep massage.
Truth served here, flavored with delectable wit, succulent sagacity, luscious logic, a gourmet meal for the mind.
I keep hearing people complain that Obama is shredding the Constitution. One of the things that he has done that supports this accusation is his use of executive orders to circumvent Congress. For example, because Congress would not go along with his amnesty plan, well, he used executive orders to frustrate and actually hinder the enforcement of immigration laws. And even bragged to that effect to a Hispanic crowd. When Congress passes a law he disagrees with, well, he just refuses to enforce it or to defend it when it's challenged, even though his job description as president and his oath of office obliges him to uphold the laws of the land. Now, by acting in this way, Obama shows that he is a law unto himself. And this is all a throwback to England's King George of the 1700s, who arrogated to himself the power to make law, rather than recognize he is given power for the specific purpose to apply and defend the law. Obama sees himself as a kind of Prometheus, stealing from the gods for the benefit of man. Obama steals the power of law from Congress, excusing his theft as for the benefit of man. In fact, that is exactly what he said in his book, Dreams from My Father, on page 276, quote, I had things to learn in law school, things that would help me bring about real change. I would learn power's currency in all its intricacy and detail, knowledge that I could now bring back to where it was needed, bring it back like Promethean fire, end quote. In other words, by his own admission, he went to law school in order to learn how he could use the law to subvert the system, to undermine the existing establishment. Which is the reason, according to Paul Sperry, the New York Post, that as soon as he got into Harvard, he, quote, sidled up to Professor Derrick Bell, who bashed the Constitution as a form of original sin, end quote. Now, in all fairness, I cannot find any place where the late Professor Bell actually used those words to describe the Constitution. The nearest I can find is a statement that Supreme Court jurist Elena Kagan edited an article for the Harvard Law Review, which was written by Professor Bell, in which this statement was used. But it appears that this is a characterization of Professor Bell's attitude toward the Constitution, taken, I think, justly from many, many things he has said that would certainly support that characterization. Having mentioned the late Professor Bell, it will be helpful to my point for you to know a little bit about Obama's favorite Harvard professor. Bell is most well known for his creation of what is called critical race theory. Now, this carefully referenced summary of Professor Bell's beliefs is provided by John Perrazzo in the Daily Mailer. And I'm reading from his article. Critical race theory contends that America is permanently racist to its core, and that consequently its legal structures are, by definition, racist and invalid. Further, critical race theory holds that because racism is so deeply ingrained in America's national character, racial preferences favoring blacks in employment and higher education are not only permissible but necessary as a means of countering the permanent character flaws of white people who, as Bell put it, seek to, quote, achieve a measure of social stability through their unspoken pact to keep blacks on the bottom, end quote. little taste of his language. Now, Bell believed that, quote, racial discrimination in the workplace is as vicious, if less obvious, than it was when employers posted signs, "No Negras Need Apply," end quote. And Perazzo goes on, saying Bell complained, in fact, that most white employers were loath to hire African Americans for any position above the most menial. Now, this professor was bitterly critical of blacks who failed to share his enthusiasm for affirmative action. He viciously condemned the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court, saying, quote, to place a person who looks black and who, in conservative terms, thinks white is an insult, end quote. Oh, there's more. Perazzo tells us, as Bell saw things, white malevolence knew no bounds. In one of his writings, he mused that if scientists were to someday develop a magical pill that could transform any black person who consumed it into a perfectly law-abiding individual, whites would undoubtedly conspire to destroy it so as to prevent such an effect. Why? Because black crime, he explained, benefits many whites, such as those who profit from the manufacture of prison uniforms, end quote. Can you believe this? Obama's mentor. It all begins to make sense. And furthermore, Bell predicted that eventually America would witness the rise of charismatic new black leaders who, in the interests of retribution, would, quote, urge that instead of blacks killing each other, they should go out in gangs and kill a whole lot of white people, end quote. And to this end, it would seem, Bell endorsed a journal called Race Traitor, whose stated aim is, quote, to abolish the white race, which means no more and no less than abolishing the privileges of the white skin, end quote. Moreover, the publication's guiding principle is, quote, treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity, end quote. In 1999, Bell signed on to a Race Traitor article that stated, quote, if the task of the 19th century was to overthrow slavery, and the task of the 20th century was to end legal segregation, the key to solving this country's problems in the 21st century is to abolish the white race as a social category. In other words, eradicate white supremacy entirely, end quote. Well, apparently, as far as Bell is concerned, the only way forward for blacks is to eradicate, quote, white supremacy entirely, end quote, which, according to what he said, requires us to, quote, abolish the white race, which means no more and no less than abolishing the privileges of the white skin, end quote. And apparently, to accomplish that, we must, quote, abolish the white race as a social category, end quote. Now, how do you do that exactly? How do you abolish an entire race as a category of humanity? There really are only two ways that could be done. One, of course, is genocide, and the other would be forced intermarriage. Now, remember Bell's prediction that America will see a rise in charismatic black men calling on his fellows to, instead of killing each other, go out and kill a, quote, whole lot of white people, end quote. Perhaps his prediction was actually a kind of call to action in a subtle way. It appears that's how many of our young inner-city black men are hearing all of this. And we're so bound up in political correctness, we can't even report the truth about black-on-white crime. Four young black men attacked two old white guys, one who was well into his 70s and the other about 59 or so, and beat them nearly to death. And the reason for this? Well, these old white guys were not comfortable that these four black teens were hanging around, loitering around their house and blocking their driveway. And it seemed to them that when they attempted to leave, they were resistant and hesitant to move out of the way, apparently in an effort to intimidate the old white guys and to provoke them into saying something, perhaps, or doing something they could use as an excuse to go off on them. By the way, don't mention the color of the skin of the kids who are playing knockout, you know, because that would be racially provocative or incendiary. But this Professor Bell can write in the Harvard Law Review incendiary statements against white people generally. And I mean, this guy went off on the entire white race as a whole, and he insists on that, by the way. And, well, that's just fine, thank you. Or if there is an occurrence of white-on-black crime, well, let's harp on that openly for months on end, non-ending. And certainly not saying that kind of thing should be ignored, but neither should the other. Obama wants some honesty in the dialogue about race relations? Really? What a joke. He was a student of Professor Bell and obviously shares his attitude toward the white race generally and toward the Constitution that it produced. He has little or no respect for the Constitution because it is, quote, white man's law, end quote. He will, like Prometheus, steal the fire of the gods, being one of them, and turn it over to the people. and the people are black. Now get this. Malcolm X was another of Obama's heroes. In Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, Obama wrote, quote, "Only Malcolm X's autobiography seemed to offer something different. His repeated acts of self-creation spoke to me, the blunt poetry of his words, his unadorned insistence on respect, promised a new and uncompromising order, martial in its discipline, forged through sheer force of will," end quote. Okay? So Obama makes it clear that Malcolm X was one of his ideological mentors, and then he offers this very revealing glimpse into his own thinking as a young man. Quote, "If Malcolm's discovery toward the end of his life that some whites might live beside him as brothers in Islam seemed to offer some hope of eventual reconciliation, that hope appeared in a distant future in a far-off land. In the meantime, I looked," that is Obama, "looked to see where the people would come from who were willing to work toward this future and populate this new world," end quote. Whoa. Where would the people come from willing to further the discovery of Malcolm X that some whites might live beside him as brothers in Islam, end quote. Did you hear that? I mean, folks, put this together, and it provides an explanation for Obama's actions as president alleged. You see, his plan for racial reconciliation is to eliminate the white race as a category, and the strategy here is to bring the races together in Islam. Now, there is the connection between Obama's racism and his sympathy for Islam. Black liberation theology comes into play also, with its teaching that the only possible way for whites to be reconciled to blacks is for whites to submit to the will of blacks. For example, consider this from the father of black liberation theology, and note the tone of this rhetoric. Quote, "In order to be Christian theology, white theology must cease being white theology and become black theology by denying whiteness as an acceptable form of human existence and affirming blackness as God's intention for humanity." That's in page 9 from A Black Theology of Liberation by James A. Cone in 1970. Now here's some more from page 11. Going on and on, he says, "Blacks know better. They know that whites have only one purpose, the destruction of everything which is not white," end quote. And I'm quoting as written here on page 12, quote, "God has chosen to make the black condition God's condition. It is a continuation of the incarnation in 20th century America. God's righteousness will liberate the oppressed of this nation and, quote, all flesh shall see it together," end quote. Quoting from the version of the Bible that he uses, by the way, "It is this certainty that makes physical life less than ultimate and thus enables blacks courageously to affirm blackness and its liberating power as ultimate. When persons feel this way, a revolution is in the making. With the assurance that God is on our side, we can begin to make ready for the inevitable, the decisive encounter between black and white existence. White appeals to wait and talk it over are irrelevant when children are dying and men and women are being tortured. We will not let Whitey cool this one with his pious love ethic, but will seek to enhance our hostility, bringing it to its full manifestation." Now, is that a threat or what? And he goes on, "Black survival is at stake here, and we blacks must define and assert the conditions necessary for our being in the world. Only we can decide how much we can endure from white racists. And as we make our decision in the midst of life and death, being and non-being, the role of black theology is to articulate this decision by pointing to the revelation of God in the black liberation struggle," end quote. I hope you're hearing this. Now get this from page 20. Barack Hussein Obama's mentor in Harvard, quote, "To be black is to be committed to destroying everything this country loves and adores," end quote. And this from page 25, quote, "The black experience is the feeling one has when attacking the enemy of black humanity by throwing a Molotov cocktail into a white-owned building and watching it go up in flames. We know, of course, that getting rid of evil takes something more than burning down buildings, but one must start somewhere," end quote. What's going on under the nod or the averted glance of Obama there in Baltimore and elsewhere? And then page 46, quote, "The black revolution in America is the revelation of God. Revelation means black power, that is, the complete emancipation of black people from white oppression by whatever means black people deem necessary," end quote. And then page 51, quote, "As the oppressed now recognize their situation in the light of God's revelation, they know that they should have killed their oppressors instead of trying to love them," end quote. Why are so many of our young black men acting so irrationally, it seems to us, targeting and attacking perfectly innocent old white guys? I mean, what's going on here? Page 55, quote, "Because whiteness by its very nature is against blackness, the black prophet is a prophet of national doom." Listen to this. "He proclaims the end of the American way. For God has stirred the soul of the black community, and now that community will stop at nothing to claim the freedom that is 350 years overdue. The black prophet is a rebel with a cause, the cause of over 25 million American blacks and all oppressed persons everywhere," end quote. The same old communist junk we've heard over and over and over. And in the same way, Islamists attempt to redefine the meaning of the language of jihad found in their Quran. Some so-called moderate black liberation theologians attempt to redefine or recast these statements, you know, for white consumption. But the actions of these radical black communities and of the present alleged make clear their meaning and their purpose and their intent. And likewise, in the same way that Islam requires absolute surrender to Islam, black liberation theology requires absolute and unconditional surrender to black dominion as the will of God for all white people. Hence the intersection between Islam and the so-called black struggle. You see, it is the intention of Barack Hussein Obama to destroy, quote, white America, end quote, and to find the people who will assist him in converting white America to Islam, as in his view, the only place where whites and blacks can meet together as equals. Notice the warm embrace he extends to white Muslims. Man, does that explain it all or what? Folks, hold on through the break. I'll be right back.
The Bible and the Bill of Rights, Sunday night, 6 p.m., beginning July 5th at the Lighthouse. Pastor Scheidbach will begin a series of five messages showing the direct relationship between the Bible and the Bill of Rights. July 5th, following the message, you're invited to a red, white, and blue cobbler delight baked by Santa Maria's own Emily Campbell, known for her dessert-alicious creations. Enjoy bluegrass music and get a chance to rub elbows with Pastor Scheidbach. You know, put a face to the voice you've heard all these years and get an answer to that nagging Bible question you've had for so long. Fun, food, fellowship, and freedom, now that's a Santa Maria-style get-together. Sunday night, July 5 at 6 p.m. at the Lighthouse. I can taste that hot cobbler already.
Lighthouse Baptist Church, 1310 West Bedarabia Road, Santa Maria.
Stand by. The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your
mind. Hello, my friends. Welcome back. I'm Jerry Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse, your brain masseur and Paul Revere's lantern lighter, lighting the lamps of the church belfry arch, singling the enemies on the march, an enemy that would steal from us our liberties. I went long in the first segment, so I'll have to be brief in my concluding remarks. Obama seems to be a study in contradictions. He claims to be Christian, and yet at the same time disdains Christians, chastises them for medieval crusades and for being, quote-unquote, less than loving, and all the while ignoring the wholesale slaughter of Christians by ISIS and snubbing our most sacred holidays, such as Easter. He says he's not Muslim, but goes out of his way to acknowledge their holy days, as no American president has ever done, and no one's failed to notice that he never speaks ill of Islam, but is defensive of it, always praising Islam, speaking warmly of the Muslims as if he had nothing but admiration and affection for both the people of Islam and the religion itself. I mean, he won't even allow the word Islam to be connected in any way with groups like ISIS, but he's very ready to throw the word Christian at the idea of crusades. Obama took a vow to uphold the Constitution, and yet he has acted in contradiction to the Constitution several times, so that even some liberals are becoming concerned that his arrogant disregard for the constitutional rule of Congress is, shall we say, problematic. He speaks of the importance of peace between the races, but foments distrust and racial tensions, it seems, at every opportunity. The three things he has been very consistent on are homosexual marriage, abortion, and amnesty. And the last segment, I offered insight into Barack Hussein Obama's background and thinking that helps you understand that Obama actually is perfectly consistent. Even though he appears to be oxymoronic, he is simply moronic. Not in the psychological sense and not with any reference to his IQ, but as an adjective describing behavior one would not expect from a mature and reasonable person. Essentially, it comes down to this. Obama was mentored by white-hating racists who believed the only place whites and blacks could ever meet together as equals was in the religion of Islam. It furthers an agenda that we'll get to a little more clearly in a moment. It explains why his policies have consistently been on the side of promoting Muslim Brotherhood, particularly throughout the Middle East. and why he has behaved so rudely toward Christians and Jews while consistently bowing and scraping to everything Muslim. And anyway, you'll need to download the show and listen to segment one if you missed it. I need to move on. A friend of mine, Jim Kaufman, sent something to me that I looked at about 20 times, and it's a picture of Obama at an event in which he allegedly gestured the single-finger salute of Muslims, which I'll explain some more about in just a moment, but being suspicious that it might be one of those knee-jerk reactions, something taken out of context, and so on. A lot of times this exercise leads me to just set it aside as whatever, and but there's a reason I'm going to go ahead and look at this one more carefully. The Snopes site, of course, denied that Obama was flashing a Muslim gang sign and provided a video clip purporting to prove it, showing us in the context of what happened there. No reasonable person would have made that conclusion. Only I noticed that the video clip has been removed. It says by user, and I'm not sure what that's about, but I couldn't get it to load and I couldn't see it, and it says it was removed. So anyway, I nevertheless read through the comments provided by Snopes, and they dismissed the index finger salute as having no significance to Muslims because they argued that the Shahada, which is the proclamation that Allah is one and Muhammad is his prophet, is a verbal thing and not a thing that's done by a gesture. But that simply showed their ignorance and their lack of study and research in the matter. Because as a matter of fact, it is well known among Muslim communities that the single index finger salute, certainly in the Middle East, is a sign of solidarity with what is called the Shahada, which again is a proclamation that Allah is one and Muhammad is his prophet. I mean, it's not unlike the movement among Christians some years ago, I think it was back in the 60s, I think, where we used the exact same sign, only in our case, we used it to signify one way, meaning Jesus is the only way, or that there was one way to heaven, which was at that time a kind of response to the hippies' peace sign. Anyway, I found the clip, however, on another site, Wonket, and I viewed it, and here's what you'll see. Obama is mounting the stage with several other dignitaries at the U.S. African Leadership Summit last August here in the United States. And as he reaches the top step, he had a very slight misstep, nothing serious, which apparently, or it might be said, stirred a little snicker and a comment or two from those who were already on the platform watching him as he approached. And that he responded to that with a gesture, which from the video angle of the event was kind of hidden from view, but would look something like maybe he gave a thumbs up and then switched it over to another gesture. That's the gesture that was captured on the photo being circulated, in which Obama is extending his index finger in a manner similar to how ISIS and other Muslims gesture the Shahada, bearing witness sign. Now, you can find several pictures of Islamic soldiers in ISIS and all over the world, really, using this gesture with one another. So Snopes is wrong about their claim that the Shahada is only a verbal declaration, or that the index finger salute has no relationship with that declaration among Muslims. However, I studied the video, and it must be admitted that it is arguable Obama was merely gesturing in response to some jibe he got from someone in the group behind him about his misstep as he approached the stage. And if not about that, perhaps some other little joke or statement or comment that might have been shot at him as he passed by. However, a careful examination of the responses he received to that gesture suggests something else was going on there, and that's what kind of caught my attention. We know that the two persons in the photo who are obviously enjoying the moment immensely are both well-known Muslims, and the looks on their faces suggest something of a bemused surprise at the gesture, which clearly they're focused on, by the way. They're looking right at that gesture. By contrast, the one person in the photo who would certainly be concerned that the president might flash such a sign was clearly not impressed. Gassing B is feeling very threatened by Boko Haram right now, and the expression on his face certainly does seem to be concern, perhaps even distress, as, like the others, he was noting President Obama's gesture. So my conclusion is that the photo is inconclusive, but Obama's behavior is clearly not inconclusive. He has consistently supported and initiated events in the Middle East, as in Libya and Egypt and elsewhere, that encouraged the hopes of Muslims who desire to revive the old caliphate or to encourage a revival of the old Ottoman Empire, which is a centuries-old ambition of radical Islam and, by the way, a stated objective of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, Shubat believes the revival of the Ottoman Empire won't be achieved by ISIS, but instead will be achieved by Turkey, and he provides some pretty insightful arguments supporting that thesis. So I think he's nearly of the mark on this. There is an interesting prophecy in the Bible concerning Turkey that includes her in an attack on Jerusalem that will ultimately fail. You'll see it in Ezekiel. Now, this will be followed by a period during which Israel will finally be accepted by her Arab neighbors and enjoy an economic alliance with a rebuilt Babylon, with a widespread expectation of a general peace throughout the region. Isaiah 2, Micah 4. A policy of religious liberty will prevail in the area. Micah 4, verse 5 makes that clear. And according to Jesus, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached throughout the entire world, every nation, Matthew 24, 14. And once this is done, then the end will come. Now, I don't have time to go into it in greater detail than to point out that this does not mean Islam is not a serious threat to our national security, or that there will not be a period during which Islam will revive the Ottoman Empire. We don't have a prophecy to that end, but it's possible it could happen. And Islam may reassert its caliphate over the Muslim world. But these events will ultimately lead to a major showdown in which Islam will be defeated. More on this in an upcoming Issachar report, but the bottom line is that the prophecy students who are saying the Antichrist will be a radical jihad-headed Muslim are simply adapting biblical prophecy to current events rather than understanding current events in the light of biblical prophecy. Fact is, he may or may not be Muslim. We don't really know. He will certainly be an Assyrian. Isaiah 10:5, Micah 5:5, and many would argue that, in today's context, that would suggest an alignment with the Muslim religion. However, we're told in Daniel 11:38, he will worship a God his fathers did not recognize. If his fathers worshipped Allah, then he will not. So it's an open question. Frankly, we don't know. What we do know is that he will worship the God of forces, whose throne, or seat, in the days the Revelation was written, was in Pergamos, Revelation 2:13, which is located in modern Turkey. In fact, interestingly, every one of the churches named in Revelation 2 and 3 was located in Turkey. I'm going to preach a message or two that sorts all this out. But the gist of it is that Obama is certainly building the scaffolding upon which future workmen will fulfill these prophecies. And the point of the show today is that while some think Obama's personal agenda probably does not go too far beyond improving his golf swing, the fact is, all of his actions feed all the monsters that want to eat America. Racial hatred, jihadist Islam, the enslavement of the American people through government dependency. To this end, his policy priorities are advancing capitalist-funded socialism, especially through environmentalism, as in the climate change scam, forcing upon the nation his views of the homosexual agenda and publicly funded abortion, and compromising the Constitution until it's virtually meaningless. But here is something you really need to wake up and see clearly. And this concludes my show today. Obama, think about it now. He's not the one shredding the Constitution. Those who are standing by and failing to stop him are the ones responsible for the breakdown of our constitutional system of governments. Look, the criminal who creates various crimes is not the one who's breaking the law down. It's those charged with the duty to enforce the laws who fail to act. Those in Congress and in our courts who have allowed this man to get away with these crimes are the ones who are shredding the Constitution. Obama is a criminal whose actions are treasonous and violations of the law of our land. Those charged with the duty to enforce our laws, to uphold our Constitution, who are standing by refusing to use the power we the people have given them to protect us from this very kind of thing, are the ones who are breaking down the law. Now, we can complain about Obama all day, every day, from now until doomsday, but it's the voters who keep sending these yahoos to Washington, and the failure of those we send there to act that is ultimately responsible for the breakdown of law and order in this country. Jeremiah complained that the prophets and the priests were selling out the people to the judgment of God, but he added, but the people love to have it so. I have lit the lamps in the church belfry arch, and now you call. Let me know you see that they are on. Call 1-888-770-8000 and say lights on if you agree, lights off if you disagree. Call 1-888-770-8000, and that's our listener response hotline. Leave a message for me. If you want me to call you back, let me know. I will. I'd be glad to talk to you. From outside the country, or those who prefer it, you can email me by going to our website at theramasawshow.com. God bless you. God save America. And I'll see you in church.
For a complete brain massage experience, tune in Saturday at 12 noon